From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Edna Buchanan about covering murder on a deadline. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her crime reporting at the Miami Herald. Also today, I talk with fashion photographer Bruce Weber. He's the man responsible for the steamy magazine ads for Calvin Klein underwear and Obsession fragrance. Weber's just made his first film, a documentary about young boxers called Broken Noses. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Dyke and the Blazers, a little-remembered soul group from Phoenix, Arizona. And book critic John Leonard reviews An Urchin in the Storm, a collection of essays by biologist Stephen Jay Gould. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Miami has one of the highest crime rates in the country, and my guest, Edna Buchanan, has been on the scene of many of those crimes. For 15 years, Buchanan has been the crime reporter for the Miami Herald. There are policemen in Miami who say a murder wouldn't be a murder without her there. In 1986, Buchanan won the Pulitzer Prize for reporting. In a profile of her in the New Yorker magazine last year, Calvin Trillin credited her with elevating the prose of crime reporting to a new level. The classic Edna lead, as he calls it, was a first paragraph that began like this. The man she loved slapped her face. Furious, she says she told him never ever to do that again. "What are you going to do, kill me?" he asked, and handed her a gun. "Here, kill me," he challenged. She did. Edna Buchanan describes the crimes she's covered and the deadlines she's met. In her new book, The Corpse Had a Familiar Face. Edna Buchanan, welcome to Fresh
Air.
Thank
you.
You know, for a lot of people, crime reporting is the place where you start, like the obituary page in a newspaper, and then you pay your dues and you move out into city politics or a foreign beat or something like that. You've stayed with it for 15 years. It seems to be your calling. What do you love about it?
Well, it's the nitty-gritty. It's what makes people become heroes or homicidal maniacs. It's got everything. Sex, greed, violence, comedy, tragedy. You can't learn as much about people on any other newspaper beat.
A lot of people think of the crime stories that you read as either ghoulish or voyeuristic or superficial. You know, just the crime stories. We want to hear the real news.
But that isn't true. A lot of people claim that they don't read crime stories, but they really do. They're the best read stories in the paper. Once the Herald commissioned this survey of cross-section of readers, and they interviewed them and had editors and psychiatrists watching from behind a glass, and all the people said, oh, no, they thought it was too much crime news. They didn't like crime news. And yet, when they asked them what name at the Herald they recognized, they all sat and thought a minute, and then simultaneously, three out of the four said Edna Buchanan. So how did they notice that name if they weren't reading the stories? So people do want to read about it because it is basics.
I think that the beat is mostly a man's world. Most of the crime reporters traditionally have been men. Most cops traditionally have been men. Detectives traditionally have been men. When you started on the beat, did you have to act extra tough to prove yourself?
No, I don't think so. I think that, you know, back then there were very few women ever sent out to cover crime stories. I was usually out there with almost exclusively other male reporters. But now when I go out to cover a crime in Miami, there are many other women out there covering crime. And I think editors have realized that a woman can cover crime in the streets as well, if not better than a man.
Early on, did your being a woman ever bring out the protective instincts of the male cops or detectives?
Occasionally, but more often, I think they would try to gross me out, you know, show me terrible crime scene pictures or a terrible crime scene or a report of some terrible sexual crime or something, seeing if it would have an effect on me. And of course, even if it did, they never saw it.
You once exploited the fact that you were a woman. It was a story about a torture chamber in somebody's basement, and all the reporters were lined up. Would you tell the story?
Yeah, it was Albert Brust who had kidnapped a teenage couple, a boy and a girl, took him back to his house. He killed the boy, shot him, and then decapitated him and cemented his body into the bathtub to cover it up. And he eventually, he raped and tortured the girl, eventually let her go, took her to Fort Lauderdale. She went directly to the police and told her story, and they didn't believe a word she said and sent her back home. And meanwhile, Brust, who'd been an immaculate housekeeper had miscalculated. The cement didn't seal. The body began to decompose, and this terrible smelling, stuff, the odor permeated the house. So the answer would have to be using a jackhammer to excavate the body, a messy job. And then, of course, it would have to be disposed of elsewhere. So Brust took the easy way out. He committed suicide in his backyard, drank a milkshake laced with cyanide. And the police, a young housewife next door, finally noticed that her neighbor hadn't moved in 2 days and called the police. And they thought at first that it was a routine suicide. And then, of course, they found something terrible rotting away under the cement in the bathtub. And this torture chamber in the house was soundproofed and padded, the doors and the windows. So I was out there with all these other reporters waiting for the police to tell us what they had there inside. They were all men, radio, TV, news service, and other print journalists. And the lieutenant finally came out, and he said he would take the reporters in one at a time for a tour of the house and the torture chamber for our stories. I was pushing deadline. I had to still drive all the way back downtown to the Herald to file my story. So without thinking, in desperation, I yelled, "Ladies first." And I got to go first and filed the nation's first story on this classic case of murder and madness. And I thought later on the way back to the Herald, was that being sexist, which is bad, or aggressive, which is considered good in this business? I think there's a fine line, and that's as close as I've come to it.
Did the male reporters realize that it was you, their competition, who had yelled out "ladies first"?
Well, obviously.
You were the only lady
they
there.
They did, yeah. And at the time, they didn't resent it. It sort of took them by surprise. Maybe today that wouldn't go over so easily, but at that time it did.
My guest is the Miami Herald's Pulitzer Prize-winning crime reporter, and she's written a new book titled "The Corpse Had a Familiar Face." What was the first time you saw a corpse while covering the beat?
That was years and years ago when I worked for a smaller paper, the Miami Beach Sun, and it was a young man who was sort of known, well-known around the beach, who was shot in a barroom brawl. And I got there, it was just after dawn, the bars close around 5 a.m., and this happened at closing time, and he was just sprawled there on the sidewalk in front of this local bar, and the police were looking for the killer, someone he'd argued with inside.
Was it hard to take the first time you saw a corpse? You've seen, 5,000 now, according to your book?
Well, I've covered 5,000 violent deaths, but this, you would have thought that it might be. I had never seen a dead body that fresh before, out, exposed and, newly dead. But it wasn't hard to take because you become very curious. You want to know what happened, who was he, what kind of bullet made that neat little hole, and could he have been saved? What was in his pockets? What happened? What caused all this? Why? Who is he? What happened, and why did it happen?
There's a great tradition of crime writing in America, and a lot of that comes from crime fiction, detective novels, and police procedurals. Do you like that kind of writing, and do you feel that you're going for that kind of writing in your coverage?
I don't know. I do like to read some of those writers. I like Donald Westlake, his wonderful black comedy. And I like, there's a series of police procedurals written in Swedish that have been translated to English, Per Wallju and Madge Lindahl. And I love to read those because it's so fascinating to see how universal police problems are. The police in Sweden bitch and complain and moan and gripe about the same things that the police in Miami and the police in Chicago and the police in Philadelphia gripe about. It's fascinating how universal all their problems are. The cop in Moscow today, faced with a murder scene, is doing the same things that a policeman in Miami with a murder scene is doing.
In your book, you write that nobody loves a crime reporter. Nobody loves a police reporter. Why?
It's true,
that?
Because we're often considered unwelcome intruders. It's human nature. Somebody gets himself in trouble, and then when you report it, he turns on you like it's your fault, not his, that he's in this mess. And, the Greeks used to kill the messenger who brought the bad news, and that attitude survives today. Many people would be delighted to revive the custom.
Are you considered a snoop, too, by the police who are trying to keep certain things cordoned off?
Yeah, they sort of they have this us and them attitude, and they resent outsiders. That's why I like often to make it clear to them that I live in Miami, I love Miami, I care about justice. The people I care about live there, so I wouldn't do anything to hurt a case or to thwart justice in any way. In fact, I may care more than they do because I live there and pay taxes, and most of the police officers in Dade County live across the county line in Broward.
You've lived in Miami for how long now?
Oh, about 25 years.
Now, when you started in Miami, when you moved to Miami, it was still known mostly for the resort hotels and the beaches, and now it's known also for its crime rate and for its drug trafficking. What were the first signs to you as a reporter that the crime rate was really going up and that the murder rate was on the rise? Were there early warning signs about that?
Well, I guess so. When I first arrived, it was sort of a sleepy southern city, a resort area that was sort of, you know, in the off season, it was quiet, things would shut down. And now, of course, it's an exotic international capital. I mean, Miami is Casablanca. And I think back then, you know, we'd have the occasional rape murder and the domestics where people who love each other wind up killing each other and the armed robberies. And now, of course, we have all of them and we have the drug traffic, which accounts for about half of the homicides and a good half of the crime that we have, if not more. And I think that, you know, the drugs started out with heroin, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, and then that leveled off and it began to build. And then, of course, there was the cocaine traffic, and then, of course, the Mariel boat lift. And we began to break all records then for violence.
You describe how five narcotics officers were shot right outside of a very posh hotel, and that people in Miami have become so blasé about crime, so used to it, that nobody moved, nobody paid much attention to this, and that people thought it was a shoot from Miami Vice. And to tell you the truth, when I read that in your book, I couldn't tell whether you were kidding or not. I couldn't tell if that was an exaggeration
or
not.
The police officers were all shot, so was an informant, and it wasn't so much that they were blasé about crime. They really just thought it was Miami Vice shooting again, because Miami Vice shoots, you know, all over the beach, all over, you know, Miami. And, you know, they heard screaming, yelling, shooting, running, police, and they just thought it was Miami Vice. And so nobody hit the floor except the police, who knew they were in trouble. So, you know, it is interesting, because in Miami now, it's so fascinating with Miami Vice, because you sort of see, you know, truth is stranger than fiction, and yet life is imitating art, and all these things are happening. And there was one occasion when a Miami Vice show had featured this sort of night spot that was called the Sex Club, and they were doing these sort of simulated sex acts on stage. And I joked about it the next day with a policewoman, and I said, gee, tourists from the Midwest are going to come here, and they're going to get off the plane and tell the cab driver, take me to the sex club, and there is no such place. But all these places, these incredible discos and these smoky places, and, you know, in the sex club that you see in Miami Vice, soon after, they appear. They're really there. You know, Miami Vice is sort of doing its own sort of urban renewal in Miami Beach. They're painting up old hotels because they're going to shoot there, and they leave them painted beautifully with murals and old gas stations they're refurbishing and using when they shoot. And sure enough, about 6 weeks later, a new club opened, and it was pretty similar to the sex club. You know, it's fascinating. Miami's a very lively place right now.
Have you ever been consulted by any of the scriptwriters from Miami Vice?
Nope, have never heard a thing from them, although I know they sort of raid our files, I guess, and of course the police files, because many of the things that you see in Miami Vice are sort of based on things that really have happened in Miami.
You've had to cover a lot of drug crime being based in Miami, and I think you learn things covering this that nobody else would know. I mean, I certainly hadn't heard of these things. For instance, that one of the techniques of trying to cross borders with cocaine is to pack cocaine into a condom and swallow the condom?
Right. Condoms are balloons. And some of these people find out the hard way what smart women have known for years, you know, that condoms aren't fail-safe. And when they start to leak and that gets into the digestive system, you know, the cocaine begins to leak out. It paralyzes the digestive system. There's no way to get that cocaine out except through surgery, and it will kill you pretty quick. A lot of people have died after the first few came into the hospitals and the medical examiner's offices, and they realized what it was. Now the doctors can save them if they get in there fast enough, because now they know what to look for and to quickly operate and get the stuff out. But some of them, I'm sure, have made it through, and others just didn't and died on the spot. I think I wrote in the one story that the man's last meal was worth $30,000, and it killed him. He had $30,000 worth of cocaine in his intestines when they opened the body for autopsy. I wonder if a lot of these people who think cocaine is fun realize how it sometimes gets to this country.
Well, it's really fascinating the extremes that people will go through for drug trafficking.
Yeah, it's big bucks. It's big money. And that big money corrupts.
It sounds very naive of me to say that. It's amazing the extremes people will go through for drugs. But really, swallowing balloons of cocaine, what a really remarkable thing to try. I remember a line from the movie Scarface in which the drug kingpin says to the Scarface character, never get high on your own supply. Have you found in your crime reporting that that really is a problem, that when people start tapping into the drugs, when they start using the drugs that they're selling, that it's their downfall?
Exactly, for sure. Because what happens is they wind up using their own stuff, and then they sort of fall into this cocaine paranoia, and they become highly suspicious of the people around them, and that's what causes a lot of these drug murders. They become suspicious of Confederates, accomplices, relatives, neighbors, and they become so paranoid they wind up killing them. Their judgment is you know, really faulty, and they're more apt to pull the trigger. They get very violent. And so that's what causes a lot of these people, these cocaine kingpins, so to speak, to wind up in these major shootouts.
Do you ever feel that you can go into a restaurant or hotel and visually identify who the drug dealers probably are?
Sure.
How?
Oh, their Rolex watches, the bulges in their clothes. They carry purses, a lot of them. And men's purses have somewhat come into vogue, but a lot of them carry it because they have a weapon in there.
Ooh.
And a lot of times you'll see somebody with a coat on and you have a, you know they've got a long gun. And, and the cars they drive, you know, there are a lot of these people. And it's interesting, in the beginning you would see these cocaine cowboys who just weeks earlier had been back in Colombia or someplace in their own backward country in the mountains riding horseback, and then they wind up in the employ of one of these cocaine kingpins. And here they are in Miami driving these Audis and Mercedes around with high-powered weaponry. And they would just shoot anybody that got in their way. They were just wild, ruthless, crazy cowboys. And after a while, when they got into these broad daylight shootings in shopping centers, they began to realize that it was causing them a lot of grief PR-wise, and they became a little bit more subtle because of the publicity. But they were pretty dangerous people. They would indulge in major shootouts on the turnpike, shooting it from passing cars at each other with machine guns in broad daylight.
Do a lot of these guys know who you are? And if they see you in a restaurant, do you feel like leaving? Because they might feel like you're on their case.
I don't think so. I've had some informants, you know, some sources who were on the witness protection plan or involved in drugs. But I don't think so. I think I'm probably the least of their worries. I mean, they're out there in their own, immersed in their little own cocaine wars, their drug wars, trying to elude the feds and the local police and everybody else.
My guest is Edna Buchanan. She won a Pulitzer Prize in 1986 for her crime reporting for the Miami Herald. She's written a book about her work. It's called The Corpse Had a Familiar Face. We're going to talk a little bit more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Miami crime reporter Edna Buchanan is my guest. Have you ever felt endangered while covering a story?
Only afterwards. And then
afterwards,
it's
thinking
too
back
late.
About
yeah,
it?
Thinking back, gee, this or that could have happened. Because when you're on deadline, you know, deadline is just coming at you like an avalanche. You know, you can't stop it. And you're just thinking about that and getting your story done. And you don't have time for these little incidental things that have no bearing on your story. And so you just tend to brush them aside. And some two men tried to rob me once when I left as I was leaving a crime scene, and I just sort of escaped and got back to the Herald, wrote my story, turned it in, and then thought about it later and thought, gee, I ought to report those guys to the police, you know, and then did belatedly, you know, retroactive, you know, it sort of hit you. But even then, you can't worry about it because you're looking at the next deadline, you know, for the next edition or the next day. And so you never really have time to fret about it. And once I nearly fell into the street on fire when a plane had crashed. A cargo plane loaded with Christmas trees. The load shifted as the plane took off, and the plane veered and crashed into a street in downtown Miami. And the street was on fire because of the jet fuel. The crew was killed, and then it hit an apartment house, which caught fire, killed some people in the apartment house. And I was out there, and I climbed up onto this third floor balcony to get a better look, and there were some homicide detectives up there, too. And I had to do a diagram. My editors wanted a diagram of the exact path of the plane, which streets that it came down before finally coming to rest. And so I was leaning over the balcony trying to get a better view, and I said to this homicide detective, "What is that street?" And as I was saying it, the railing buckled and I began to pitch forward. Now I would have just fallen down to the street that was on fire below. And this quick, you know, reacting homicide detective grabbed me by my belt from behind and pulled me back up. And you know, and of course, he was just really shaken. He was trembling all over. And as he pulled me back up, I finished the sentence, said, "Over there, you know, what is that street? Over there." And he said, "You're crazy. You know, you almost got killed." And he was all upset and, you know, shaky. And I sort of forgot about it, finished getting my diagram, worked on the story, you know, around the clock until, you know, the latest deadline, got the story in, and sort of forgot about that. And didn't remember it again until I went to the police station a day or two later. And he went into this big tirade again and, you know, how I'd almost been killed and he'd saved my life and he was telling everybody about it. And it didn't even really occur to me at the time because I just had to get that diagram. I had to get it from my editors. I had to find out how many people had been killed. And you're so intent on the story, on that goal, that nothing else really gets in your way. It's like being obsessed. You're just looking down a tunnel and to that light, which is your deadline and your story, and you've got to do what you have to do.
I think another thing that you're really concerned with is being first with whatever story you're covering. And it's hard to do because it's in some ways easier for TV to cover because they can just...
Sure, the immediacy.
They can just like run back in and get on the air, whereas you have to write it up and it has to go to press before your story is officially out. What are some of the ways that you make sure you have the story before anybody else does? Not only in getting back to the paper first, but in making sure you have the information before your competitors do.
Well, it's hard. Each story is different.
It's different, yeah.
But you have to be sort of unobtrusive and just go about your business and work fast and not make a lot of noise that will attract the other media to make them aware of what you're doing. And you just have to really get out there and work.
Do you make a series of phone calls every day to...
And I listen to the scanner before I go to work so I sort of know what's going on and if there's any scenes to go out to directly or if I should just go to the police stations and see what's happening there. And you just go out and beat the bushes and you really work. And then what sort of ticks me off sometimes is the TV and radio people get upset and they say... they go after the police and say, "How come she had that story and we didn't?" And they're sitting there in their air-conditioned offices waiting for the press release. And then they're angry that we have a story that I went out and worked all night and beat the bushes and scoured a neighborhood to get. And so often the police will say, "Well, wait a minute. When I go to them finally for confirmation before I put the story in the paper, they say, "Well, wait a minute. You know, if we tell you about this, we better put out a press release when I'm the one that's really worked out there and unearthed the information." So it's a constant battle because there are a lot of these people who just want to wait for the handout, but then they get incensed if you beat them.
I'm glad you mentioned the handout and the police press releases. You do a good job making fun of them in your book about the really impenetrable language that you find in the police press releases.
Yeah, it's like I'm trying to translate a foreign language into English. You know, and it's funny because police speak in a very colorful fashion ordinarily, and yet they write, you know, that the subject, you know, left the dwelling and proceeded in an easterly direction in a, you know, late model, you know, light color vehicle. So you don't know if vehicle, you know, if that means a car or a pickup truck or whatever. You don't know if the dwelling is a condo or a, you know, a trailer or an apartment house or a private home. You don't know if the subject that they're talking about is male, female, old, young. You know, they can really drive you crazy.
It's an odd thing.
And they always say weapon or firearm. They don't say 38 caliber snub nose or something, you know. And they could, but they just somehow speak in this strange jargon, which any reporter, you know, who uses it is guilty of a second-degree misdemeanor, because you really shouldn't allow that to creep into your copy. It's not good.
You also make it clear that you mistrust a lot of editors. What are some of the reasons?
Well, editors can burn your sources.
How would they ruin a source for you?
Well, if an editor, you just turn in your story and go home, and if you do that, it's like sending out your teenage daughter on a date with Theodore Bundy, because, you know, you just can't do that, because an editor will somehow decide he wants to change this or that. It could be something that makes your source irate or even exposes your source. He can decide to drop a mistake in there, or he can put a headline on it that doesn't make sense, or decide he wants to change the lead and wind up putting a mistake in it. Or he can, you know, there's so many bad things an editor can do to your story. He can take out a first reference to someone, so you really look stupid. There's only a second reference in there without a first name or a title. And so you've got to look over their shoulder. You've got to sort of mother hen your stories. You've got to always stay on it and make sure that they check with you before they change anything. If something has to be shortened, you'll do it together, if need be, over the telephone. But take your carbons home and your copies home, your printouts, and stay on top of it. I can't walk away.
A lot of people who live in cities are very worried about crime, because crime rates in cities tend to be high. Miami is especially high. And you are so cognizant of crime because you're covering it all the time. Now, it sounds like you're so obsessed with deadlines that you don't worry about the possibility of being victimized. But is this in back of your mind because you're so aware of all the crime that there is in the city that you live?
Yeah, I try to stay alert and be careful because I know what can happen out there.
What are some of the things that you've learned? You've probably picked up a lot of tips from the police who you work with about things to watch out for, so that you'll notice someone before they commit a crime against you.
Yeah, well, and yet, you know, Miami is so beautiful, and people come down there and they want to sort of retire and relax and just sort of stroll along dreamily in the sunshine and daydream, and you can't. You know, you have to be alert at all times. Your body language says a lot. If you're not feeling well, you're just sort of shuffling, or you're looking vulnerable, you know, then you are more vulnerable, because, you know, studies and such have shown that often these perpetrators will pick out somebody just by virtue of body language, or if you just sort of look bewildered or dazed, or like you don't quite know where you're going. When you're out there on the street, you have to walk sort of purposely and look like you know where you're going. Even if you don't feel well, try to look strong and tough and like, you know. And if somebody approaches you, sort of look them in the eye. Don't sort of try to, you know, sidle away, but look them in the eye. Look them straight in the eye. They don't like that. You have to lock your car doors. Be careful when you're approaching an intersection. If you see somebody you don't like there, you may have to run a red light, but do it if you can do it safely.
I'm going to ask you quickly. Now, you have shoulder-length hair that's very, it's a very kind of windblown type of hairdo, very full, very thick, down to your shoulders. Is that hairstyle, does it call attention to you at all? It's a very, quote, feminine kind of hairstyle?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know. I know that a lot of people recognize me by sight that I deal with on the job. I don't know if, I don't think I'm deliberately trying to call attention to myself. So,
but when you're on the beat, do you try to wear like tough looking clothes, anything like that?
No, it was interesting. The first few years I worked for the Herald, I sort of always wore dresses because I was very aware of representing the Herald. But then after slogging through the Everglades and riding on airboats in high heels, usually now I wear slacks and comfortable shoes and a nice blouse or something.
Edna Buchanan, I want to thank you very much for telling us about your work. It's been interesting to have you here. Oh, thanks.
Thank you.
My guest has been Edna Buchanan, the Pulitzer Prize-winning crime reporter for the Miami Herald. Her new book is titled The Corpse Had a Familiar Face. It's published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with film director Alan Rudolph. He's directed the films Choose Me and Welcome to L.A. His new film, Made in Heaven, stars Timothy Hutton and Kelly McGillis. It opens this week. I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with fashion photographer Bruce Weber. He created the eye-catching Obsession magazine ads featuring statuesque nude men and women. Now he's made a documentary about young boxers called Broken Noses. Also, rock historian Ed Ward reviews the career of Dyke and the Blazers, a Phoenix group whose one big hit changed the sound of soul music. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new collection of essays by biologist Stephen Jay Gould. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards in Washington. Administration officials confirm that Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger will step down this week. He's reportedly leaving for personal reasons after nearly 7 years in the Reagan cabinet. White House officials say President Reagan will name National Security Advisor Frank Carlucci to replace Weinberger, and Carlucci's deputy lieutenant, Carlucci's deputy, Lieutenant General Colin Powell, will succeed Carlucci. If the job swap goes through, Powell would become the first black to serve as National Security Advisor. Washington, D.C. police took into custody today a man suspected of threatening the life of Secretary of State George Shultz. State Department spokesman Charles Redmond said that Edward L. Gallo of Worcester, Massachusetts, was found with guns and hundreds of rounds of ammunition in his car at a motel in the nation's capital.
Based on information received from the Worcester, Massachusetts Police Department, the State Department's Bureau of Diplomatic Security had increased its protection of the Secretary and had launched an intensive investigation. As a result of that investigation, the man was arrested this morning by the Metropolitan Police Department.
The suspect says he was passing through the area on a hunting trip. A new face in the Reagan cabinet. The president today nominated Anne McLaughlin as labor secretary. She would replace William Brock, who resigned to join the presidential campaign of Republican Senator Robert Dole. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
McLaughlin has served before in the Reagan administration as Assistant Treasury Secretary for Public Affairs and later as Undersecretary of the Interior, a post she held for 3 years before resigning last March. She is married to TV host John McLaughlin, and the president joked she should have no trouble at the Labor Department because if she's handled John this long, she can handle anything. The president said that McLaughlin rejoins his administration as it attempts to cut the deficit and keep the economy expanding.
As we move to solve the budget deficit and preparing America for the 21st century, one of those I'll be looking to for advice and help will be Anne McLaughlin.
During the ceremony today, the president restated his opposition to a protectionist trade bill being considered in Congress and said he's gotten a letter from 38 senators who have pledged to uphold his veto of the measure if it's not changed. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
It was a down day on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged more than 50 points to close at 1963.53. Analysts say a technical reaction to recent gains in stock prices and fresh concerns about the fall of the dollar may have caused today's sharp drop. Declines led advances 3-1 on a volume of 229 million shares. The Reverend Jerry Falwell today announced his resignation as president of the Moral Majority. Falwell says he's stepping down from the top position to devote more time to what he called his first love.
I am now rededicating my life to the preaching of the gospel and the planting and the starting of Bible-believing churches internationally, the training of young people at Liberty University, the development of our ministry to unborn babies and pregnant teenage girls, and in general, the development of a Christian 911 ministry of mercy to the hurting nationally.
Falwell says he will remain on the board of directors of the powerful right-wing political organization. He's been a political activist since 1979, when he became a leader in the effort to forge a coalition of religious and social conservatives. The trial of former White House official Michael Deaver reconvened today in Washington. Deaver is on trial for perjury in connection with his lobbying business after leaving the White House. Today, Philip Morris tobacco officials told how they paid Deaver to lobby the South Korean government on a cigarette licensing deal. Deaver's accused of lying to cover up his attempts to use White House connections to get Philip Morris access to Korean President Chun Doo-hwan. I'm Michael Richards, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of Dyke and the Blazers. Back in the mid-60s, they were one of the groups that pioneered funk.
There aren't a whole lot of black people in Phoenix, Arizona these days, and there's no reason to think there were any more in 1966 when something happened that put Phoenix on the soul music map. The OJs, who at that time were a struggling young vocal group with one hit, Stand In for Love, to their credit, had a gig there, and when their bus pulled out, they were missing a few of their backup musicians, who were called the Blazers. Among the missing were their bass player, Arlister Christian, and several other members of the group. But missing that bus was the best thing the guys ever did. It would take the OJs another 5 years to get famous, but Arlister Christian, who was known as Dyke, and the Blazers were about to have their moment in the sun. Dyke set about finding local musicians to fill in for the Blazers who had caught the bus, and soon had the Phoenix clubs jumping with a new dance Dyke had invented, the Broadway. To promote it, they went into the studio and knocked out the tune that would make them famous, the Funky Broadway. Such a huge hit that the local label that had released it soon had to lease it to an L.A. label, and Dyke and the Blazers toured the country while Funky Broadway was on its way to selling a million copies. It was such a durable hit that when Wilson Pickett released it in the summer of 1967, just a few months after Dyke's version died, he took it back to the top of the charts. Dyke and the Blazers ran back to Phoenix and recorded some follow-ups, including So Sharp. There was also The Wrong House, a 10-minute epic that showed off Dyke's almost childlike conception of lyrics, telling a convoluted story about Dyke, his efforts to get a job, and his girlfriend, who leaves him for a great big giant, as if there were any other kind, who mostly says, "Brrr." Some dismissed Dyke as a second-rate James Brown, but others thought he was a primitive genius. Soon, he was recording in L.A. with studio musicians who could stay in tune and hold the groove, cutting masterpieces like Let a Woman Be a Woman, Let a Man Be a Man. There was the tribute to Black Pride, We Got More Soul. Everything he recorded hit the soul charts in the late 60s. But Dyke was never comfortable with stardom. Time and again he'd return to South Phoenix to hang out with his friends. The record company found him hard to handle, and the hits stopped coming. He was shot to death in 1971 during an argument there in Phoenix, down on Broadway, filthy, nasty Broadway, funky, funky Broadway.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. Come on. This is Fresh Air. My guest is photographer Bruce Weber. He's best known for his sexually charged magazine ads for Calvin Klein underwear and Obsession fragrance. His non-fashion work was included in the 1987 Whitney Biennial. Weber's first film, Broken Noses, has its American premiere this week in New York. It's a documentary about Andy Minsker, a lightweight pro boxer and leader of a boxing club for boys. In 1983, Weber was on assignment for Interview Magazine, shooting young Olympic hopefuls at the Colorado Sports Festival. It was through a photograph of a boxer named Nathan Hauser that he met Andy Minsker.
Nathan came down to where we were photographing, you know, and we said, well, what would you like to wear? And, you know, we have all these things, and there was like something that you put underneath something. It was sort of like a dance belt that dancers wear underneath their leotards. And he says, oh, I want to wear that. I have a great body. And we said, well, great, you know. And he put it on and we did the pictures and he didn't seem to mind. But then he went back to the Boxing Federation and they said, hey, why are you, you know, photographing boxers like this? That's really terrible, you know. And I said, why is it so terrible? You know, women have been showing their bodies for years. And they said, well, no, you don't understand. This is a sport and so forth and so on. And it was pretty amazing. We had to go in front of them and defend our photographs, defend the reason we were at the festival. And it was pretty wild, you know.
And then that's how Andy Minsker found you?
Well, at that point, we had just met Andy, and they told him that he couldn't come to the photo session, and he came.
What interested you in doing a film about young boxers?
Well, It's funny. I have a team, a crazy team that I go on the road with. And there's a hairdresser, and his name is Didier Milige. And Didier grew up in Paris, and he was a boxer. And Didier sort of got me and the rest of my buddies really, really interested in boxing. And so I really started photographing a lot of boxers, and I really love their exhibitionistic quality in photographs. They were never afraid of the camera, you know, and they really felt that it was like a real special time for them, and it should be recorded. And I love that attitude, you know. I always felt that dancers had that same attitude.
You know, I almost think that there's a sexual haze over the whole film. The film is almost like a reverie about beautiful young male bodies. And you even have some romantic ballads playing in the background as the young boys train.
Well, it's funny. I really chose the jazz music that I did because I really felt that there's a sense of elegance to boxing and to a dedication of one's life, and then to be just saying, oh, all these boys have really beautiful bodies. I mean, they're young kids, you know. I didn't really feel that at all, no.
I think of you as being one of the first fashion photographers to shoot men in very sexual poses. I'm thinking especially of the Calvin Klein underwear ads. And I'd like to ask you if you felt that you had to find a language for shooting men in really sexy poses. And what I mean by that is that women have always, in American popular culture, been shown as really sexual beings. And men have always been much more straightforward, you know, in ads, really like down to business. Did you feel like you had to find a different language?
No, I just sort of, you know, I was kind of like a real beachy kid, you know, and a lot of my friends were much more concerned with the way their bodies were than maybe I was, because I wasn't particularly a great athlete, you know. I was always like, you know, into art class and, you know, and looking at fashion magazines and listening to music, jazz particularly. And I really felt that the thing that I felt kind of crazy was I was just photographing my friends or people I knew, you know, and they had a different sensibility about their body than I did. And I felt that maybe it was about time for men to be able to be photographed, I mean, in a certain way. I mean, I love it, you know, like if a woman comes up to me and she goes, oh, who's that guy in that picture, you know? And sometimes the guy has on a suit and a tie. I really like it that she finds that man attractive and that women can say, hey, you know, I really want to know that man in that photograph. I think that's pretty healthy.
What do you mean when you say that your friends had a different sense about their bodies than you did about yours?
Well, I think that they sort of felt that you know, that they were very proud of their bodies. They really liked it. You know, that was kind of a new thing in those days for men to feel that way. You know, when a guy grows up in America, you know, he's told not to think he's handsome. He's told not to think he has a good body because that's being a real sissy.
One of your recent ads is for Obsession for Men. And the ad is of six very bronzed, naked women, men and women. And they're posed almost as if they were Greek statues. They're naked, and you see their behinds, but you know there's no breasts or genitals that are shown in the ad. It seemed like a very daring ad in a way. I certainly had never seen anything quite like it in a magazine before for an advertisement.
God, what do you want me to say about it? I don't know. You know, I took the picture.
It seems like you're really stretching the limits that have existed in advertising.
I really don't think so at all. I mean, I'm just out there, you know, taking photographs, you know.
But it's something new. I mean, I'd never seen that in a magazine before in an ad. Did you? I certainly hadn't.
No, I guess I hadn't, but I don't know if it's so, if they're really stretching it, if, I think that, you know, especially now in the time that we're living in, you know, where with AIDS and all the things going on in the world, you know, I think it's really nice for people to be able to look at something and be able to fantasize and to dream or to be able to have fun, whether it's a portrait of a girl or guy and they're nude or whether it's a beautiful car. I think it's the same thing. I think we all need that right now, you know?
Well, that's a really interesting point. Now that people are somewhat more reluctant to enter into relationships, you think it's become more important to have beautiful images to dream about?
I think so. Yeah, I really, really do think so. At least I think it is for me. You know, I think it is for the people that I'm surrounded by and that I work with. I really feel that, you know, that we want to give something back. You know, I photograph a lot of young kids all the time, all over the world, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think, well, guys, you know, they can't be like me when I was like 18 or 19, you know, hanging out and, you know, having a great time all the time, you know. And I just feel that it's nice for them to be able to fantasize and like what you say, you know, have something really beautiful to look at.
Your next film is going to be a documentary about jazz trumpeter Chet Baker. This is a documentary, right? Or is it a fiction film?
No, it's a film. It's kind of a mixture of a documentary, a mystery, a musical. You know, everything, all three of those things.
So Chet Baker is in it.
Yes, definitely.
What has he meant to you? You're obviously very. You really like his music. Even use some of his music in your movie about the boxers.
Right. What does Chet mean to me? Well, it's pretty hard to say. I'm in the middle of editing a film that I've been working on, you know, now for about a year. And it's pretty wild to say, answer that question, you know, because it changes every day, you know. I think one thing that he really represents to me is a man who, above all, you know, really loved his music, his jazz. I first saw Chet. I bought an album when I was like about 16 years old called Let's Get Lost, and I was standing on the corner years later in New York City and in front of Tiffany's, and it was Christmas time and it was snowing, and all of a sudden this convertible pulled up with the top down, and there was Chet sitting in the car with the tweed jacket on and his hair all slicked back and the snow coming all over inside the car. And everybody in the corner was staring at this guy, you know, in the snowstorm in a convertible. It was so beautiful, you know, that image. And ever since then, I always really felt that I wanted to photograph this man and make a film on him.
Do you like to be photographed yourself?
Oh, I hate it. hate it.
You know, earlier on in the interview, you mentioned that you used to be more self-conscious about your bodies than a lot of your friends. Being around people who are very physically attractive, has that made you any more or less self-conscious about yourself?
Well, it's funny you say that. It's an interesting point because a lot of people on my crew, you know, they'll say, oh, like if it's a girl, you know, she'll say, oh, look at all these beautiful girls. My body's not as good as theirs. I don't know. I don't really feel that so much anymore, you know, because my images of what's good looking are always changing, you know, so I can't really, like, you know, say too much about that. As also, I'm really getting interested in, and one of the reasons why I made Broken Noses, and maybe why I even called it Broken Noses 2, is that I was getting much more interested in a little bit more of a frayed beauty, you know, a beauty that's somehow been slightly damaged or slightly taken away, a little bit like Andy's and Broken Noses, and a little bit like Chet's, you know. And so I don't really compare myself in a sense anymore to, Oh, that guy has a great body. I wish I looked like that, you know, something like that. I don't really think too much about that anymore.
Bruce Weber's film Broken Noses opens November 4th at the Film Forum in New York City. It shows November 13th in Santa Monica, California, and begins a week-long run at the Castro Theater in San Francisco on December 11th. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, we'll have a report tonight that Chinese leaders have assured a State Department official visiting Beijing that the People's Republic will prevent Chinese-made weapons from reaching Iran. It's been the Chinese Sokrom missiles, of course, that have been used against Kuwait and also the U.S. Also, a senior Sandinista military official apparently has defected to the United States. The State Department won't confirm the report, but the Nicaraguan government is upset. The Sandinista government says that this official has Nicaraguan money and they want him extradited. Also, some music tonight from Hawaii. Slack key guitarist Raymond Kani.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Stephen Jay Gould is a professor of biology, geology, and the history of science at Harvard University. He's defended Darwin's theory of evolution against attacks by creationists, sociobiologists, and others. Now there's a new collection of books by Gould, which first appeared in the New York Review of Books. Critic John Leonard has a review.
There are two Stephen Jay Goulds. One of them, the scientist professor, gives his heavy books on time and evolution to Harvard University Press. The other, Citizen Gould, writes book reviews for The Intelligent Layman, which are every several years collected and published by Norton. The latest of these collections, An Urchin in the Storm, presumes that we know a little biology and want to hear more of what modern science has to say about history and politics and ethics. It is a splendid scourge. Whether he is talking about pigeons or panda bears, beetles or baboons, kiwis or cuckoos or flying fish or chromosomes, Citizen Gould's particulars are always a launching pad into the vast diversity of nature. This diversity is the stick he uses to beat on the thick heads of reductionists and determinists, and especially sociobiologists like E.O. Wilson, who'd have us believe that the world today is exactly the way it should be, that everything from the status of women to the IQ scores of black schoolchildren to the caste system in India is the result of a tyranny of the genes, that if the people in charge on top seem mostly male and mostly pale, talk to Darwin about it. But evolution, Gould insists, has never been a ladder or a chain of being. It is instead a ramifying bush with a million branches. Natural selection is messy. What we see around us or in the mirror is as much a consequence of chance, contingency, compromise, and quirk as it is the product of necessity or design. Gould reminds us that some adaptations are dandy, but others are inefficient, and a few produce byproducts, unpredictable problems and skills and utilities that end up being at least as crucial to the surprised species as a long intestine or a cloven hoof. Our big brain, for instance, didn't develop just so we'd feel bad on realizing we have to die, but our thinking about death shapes a lot of what we do with our lives. Nor is natural selection the only way for humans to evolve. Cultures determine us as much as genes do, and cultures subject to climate and conquest and the spread of new technologies alter in a flash. 5 minutes with a wheel, he says, or a snowshoe, or a bow and arrow, allows an artisan of one culture to appropriate another's genius. Sure, biology constrains us, but we are amazingly free to improvise new selves in what he calls the dialectic or interaction of this genetic architecture with the plasticity of the living environment. It is this sense of possibility in diversity that Citizen Gould promotes as he goes about bashing the sociobiologists for their bad science and sloppy thinking in the service of an ugly status quo. He conscripts for his cause not only Archimedes, Copernicus, Darwin, and Einstein, not merely Virgil, Marx, and Freud, but Jesse James and Gilbert and Sullivan, Kurt Vonnegut and Lord Peter Wimsey, Frank Capra movies and Herblock cartoons, as if to jolt us into political action by the very dazzle of life, the surprises he finds in the deep time of the earth sciences. He's really terrific.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and he's a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed An Urchin in the Storm by Stephen Jay Gould. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with choreographer Lar Lubavitch. He choreographed Stephen Sondheim's new musical, Into the Woods. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review an album of contemporary Chinese piano music performed by Jeffrey Jacob. And Jan-Harald Brunvand will be back with more urban legends. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Orji Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.